Yeah, we should actually.
I mean, just a quick plug.
Yeah. We're live.
Well, we're live. Go ahead and plug it.
Plug it.
The quick plug.
Chill away.
Chill, Dave. Chill, baby, chill.
Well, the quick plug is that on last week's episode, Max had a good idea. We were talking about custody, and Max had a good idea. You know, there's already a project called Wallet Scrutiny, which scrutinizes wallets, particularly non-custodial wallets. And Max is like, why isn't there an exchange scrutiny? I think the idea immediately made sense to David and me as well. So we reached out to the Wallet Scrutiny project. They liked it as well. So they're going to start working on exchange scrutiny. So props to you, Max, for the idea, and happy this show could be the genesis of that.
But now
have to do the work to
the hard work of making
It's an open source project though. So anyone listening who would like to contribute, please go to Wallet Scrutiny and help out.
Does that mean there's going to be a new URL as well, Exchange Scrutiny, or Wallet Scrutiny will now have exchanges too?
I didn't see them talk about that. I think they had to figure out exactly how to, host it. I'll leave that to them.
Fair enough. All right.
And what are the, I think we had sort of talked a little bit about what it could be, and I saw some interaction on Twitter about how they can do some pieces and they can't do other pieces. Do we know, and then I think Steve, you wrote up some of the details of what you thought it could be. Is that right? It's in the GitHub repo now?
Yeah. GitLab repo. They use GitLab.
GitLab repo. Okay.
Ooh, all right.
But there's an issue in their GitLab that I came up with 13 things that I would care about in evaluating whether, to the degree I would trust a third party custodian. There's no doubt there's more. Like, if either of you guys or anyone listening would like to add to that, please give it.
They were talking about trying to do like due diligence on the liabilities, the company stuff that just didn't seem like it was going to be, any reasonable possible without any type of extremely heavy lift. So I was wondering, you've got these 13 ideas. Are the core ideas something like, does it have a vaulting service? Does it use, FIDO or UTF-8?
They're all either externally verifiable or it's realistic for a third party custodian to make that information available. And if they don't make it available, then I think you assume the worst when you're ranking it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I mean, hopefully this not only helps people decide which exchanges are safer to potentially custody with, but also maybe it will push a lot of other exchanges that haven't to adopt things like proof of reserves. And that would be awesome for the whole industry.
Yeah, I think once you set the standard, you make everybody rise to it. And if they're not rising to the standard, then there's a problem. You got to wonder why they're not.
I agree. And I mean, there's carrot and stick approaches. I think it's always preferable to use carrot if it works. And this can be a carrot, right? So just like with wallet scrutiny, there's, a handful of wallets that pass their tests and sort of get the thumbs up. So kudos to those projects, and they should be like, they should use that in their marketing. People should praise it. It should be on social media, and it should be a win for those wallets. And then other wallets will be like, we need to prioritize this because we're losing share. We're losing users. Same with exchanges.
Yeah. I mean, the carrot is get more users. The stick is lose your customers.
Well, the stick being like another approach that Bitcoiners are really good at is yelling and screaming. Yelling, screaming, and shaming. So we can yell and scream at what we deem like the bad exchanges, but I think that's easily dismissed. Sometimes it works, but it can be easily dismissed as like crazy people and just ignore, especially if your business isn't impacted. If your business is impacted, then whether or not someone's yelling and screaming doesn't really matter. It's like you want to address your business.
Yep. Get more flies with honey. I think it's always good to praise. It's constructive, right? Like if someone's mad at you, you don't know why they're mad. Now you know exactly what you can do. So everyone should implement proof of reserves immediately.
Get more flies with honey. That's that's Max's Southern.
That's a Southern
instinct.
Aphorism for you. Oh, it is. It's a very Southern one.
Right. I'm from the Midwest. Whenever I say, you can't get blood from a turnip, people are like, what? You can't get water from a stone.
There you go.
But in the Midwest, Steve, do you guys say the turnip line or?
No.
Okay.
I'm not having any of this clownery.
But calling soda pop is definitely an Iowa thing, maybe a Midwest thing.
So I didn't realize that until I moved out of the Midwest, and then people like, you know, knew I was from the Midwest when I called it pop. So I don't call it pop anymore. Also, Davenport, like, first of all, the city in Iowa, but
big
I'm
city
referring
in Iowa,
to,
yeah.
I'm referring to couches. Who calls couches Davenport?
You never heard of that.
Iowans do.
Interesting.
I've heard of that. Yes. I it's like, you know, locked away from 30, 40 years ago, but yeah, I've heard of that. Was there like a big furniture manufacturer distributor in Davenport?
Maybe. And maybe that's why it's an Iowa thing.
While we're on the topic of fun personal things, DK, after our last discussion last week, Steve and I had a nice little lengthy chat about some NCAA basketball. I know we gave a shout out to Tyrese Hunter last week. And I think there's some plans to have pretty lit March Madness this year in whatever undisclosed location we all may be hanging at. So just going to put, in case there's someone out there listening that wants to build an easy to use lightning powered or eCash powered NCAA March Madness bracket, you got 2 months or less, 6 weeks. And that would be a lot of fun. So
we will,
putting that out there.
And we will guarantee we'll use it and we'll shill it. If someone builds that,
If you send me a hat, it might work.
Maybe even David will become a basketball player.
If it involves gambling, you know I'm in. Or adult or gambling.
No comment.
This is a family.
The brick.
This is a family.
Very family friendly show.
The bricks that built the internet, boy. Come on. So speaking of things that are not very palatable, OpenAI had a big launch this morning, operator. Did you guys see this? Do you know what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I saw it. I understand the high-level concept. I didn't look at the details.
What's the TLDR?
So everybody's talking about, you know, the internet, the agentic future, how AI is going to be able to, you know, control websites and stuff like that. Well, today, OpenAI launched this service called Operator that is that, and it's only available to people in the US, I think, at the $200 tier yet. And so what you do is you go in and, like, in the demo example, they say, you know, book me a trip to Joshua Tree National Park or something. And then they show it navigates to a website, HipCamp, which is kind of like an Airbnb for campsites. And it prompts that thing and it shows you the different actions that it's taking as it's taking it. So it's like you're watching a chat session and it's taking actions on the web, and you can always interrupt it and take your own actions or correct it or change it. But effectively, it demonstrates how an AI agent would control, you know, an application or service on the public internet. And presumably you'd string a bunch of these together and it would do kind of everything you would want to do. So if you're, you know, we already see how kind of creative writing and creativity gets impacted by AI, but also things like, you know, e-commerce shopping or, you know, planning a trip or any kind of complex thing. And I think, I found that interesting. I've seen lots of hypotheses that this kind of thing would be coming and that it should be here at some point. Wow. But I think if you sort of, you know, you take like the product today, it's like, oh, cool, that looks really useful. Maybe we could use that. But if you take it and you project it out, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, it starts to make you wonder, like, will any of us ever want to interact with the internet? And is the internet just going to be a bunch of plumbing, a bunch of like interconnect of apps and APIs all talking to each other, but we're just dispatching commands to services, to AIs and agents, and then the actual like activity on the internet that we have today is all just run by kind of bots that are hopefully mostly in our control. But, you know, obviously also there's the nefarious side of bots creating content that kind of doesn't matter and stuff. So I saw that this morning. I thought it was really good. I mean, it was just announced like an hour or two ago. I thought that was kind of cool. It touched on this theme that, Max, you've mentioned before, but haven't fully kind of explained the whole theory. But I thought it was a nice intro to dovetail into the theory of the dead internet theory.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that kind of inspires you, sort of the connections already obvious, or you want to sort of lay it up for us what that is.
No, totally. And very skillfully done, DK. I like the preamble and the nice story weaving there. You know, I think
from
a while,
gambling to adult,
like, your job as a storyteller is safe while these operators are out there doing anything. No, I do. I mean, I appreciate that. And I want to jump in and talk about dead internet theory. But before I do that, I mean, you talking about operator, I actually have not seen that this morning yet. And so it's sparking so many different thoughts in my mind. So just quick raw take on that before we get into dead internet theory. Number one, I had like waves of like excitement and euphoria, and then like terror just thinking through all this. So here was my original like thought process real time as you were speaking. Number one, exciting. I absolutely hate doing just like administrative operational tasks. And you know, my strategy, I don't have an assistant or anything like that. So my strategy is just to avoid the crap that I don't want to do and like hope it never has to get done. And if it becomes painful enough that I actually have to do it, then I do it. But like, I just kind of ignore it and hope it goes away. And so the first part of me is like, oh man, that would be so awesome. For example, things like shopping for, you know, a car and getting insurance, or like scheduling an appointment at the DMV, or even like, I hurt my shoulder recently and, you know, trying to set up a doctor's appointment and physical therapy and all this. It's just horror. And so having someone that could, you could do at a $200 a month price point, which by the way, I mean, now I'm starting to see like, that doesn't seem that much. Because a human assistant for a few hours, you know, a month is going to be substantially more than
that. I think that that's just an early throttle. I think that's just like a slow rollout. I think this is basically
amazing.
You know, $10 a month or whatever, right?
Exactly. So if you can bring that kind of, I think this is the promise, you know, eventually this is going to happen in the physical realm too. This is why Elon says his robots are going to be the greatest, you know, product of all time. You know, there's the old sort of trope that, you know, technology that kind of, you know, takes what was once a luxury experience for kings and makes it available to everyone. That's essentially like the story of like which products succeed. And yes, having an assistant that's super reliable, super cheap, knows you super well, of course that's going to be a huge hit. And it makes a lot of sense. Same with once you can have, you know, a robot in your house that, you know, brings you whatever, your custom meals and all that stuff. Both are going to be huge hits. My next thought though is, before even getting into how this affects the plumbing of the internet, is like the horror of like, if that all becomes a company controlling this, like OpenAI, man, it feels so much like just like the early days of using Google and Facebook again, or Facebook being even worse. Like, we're about to go through on the same pattern where it's like, hey, there's this awesome technological service. It makes my life a lot better. And like, guess what? I'm going to tell it everything. Here, let me just upload my medical records and have it make the appointments for me. Sure is awesome. You know, and it's going to be like the frog boiling, you know, for the first couple of years, it's going to be exciting and amazing. And then all of a sudden, you know, in ways that are either subtle and or potentially very explicit, that information right now I'm going to call is going to come back to bite you in a way that everyone's going to absolutely hate. And there's going to be a huge reaction against with OpenAI or whoever it is winning. If it's a centralized company having access to too much data, and I don't know exactly where it leads to, probably like, you know, it's the kind of subtle programming we already have with things like Twitter on steroids. But anyways, it just reinforced me. I want that service, but personally, I think the importance of having that in a way that I can either move from cloud to cloud or run locally is like athleisure.
Yep. And the comical thing about this is, you know, just as the DOJ is talking about trying to split the Chrome browser as a separate entity from Google, the idea of a browser becomes kind of obviated and unnecessary, because like, whether OpenAI controls it or Google controls it or Apple controls some centralized or decentralized entity, like the browser probably doesn't matter, you know, in over some time frame, like not tomorrow, but like 6 months, a year, 10 years, like somewhere in there.
Yeah. And then to your next point on the plumbing, which will dovetail into that in that theory, but the plumbing part I think is absolutely spot on. And something I've been thinking about and, you know, putting on my investor hat a little bit as well is, you know, in the long run, I think intelligence is going to absolutely be good enough to operate through any environment, human environment or environments we can't even dream of yet. But in this transition phase over the next, let's call it 3 to 5 years, my guess is you're going to see the first really big adoptions and wins happen in kind of like custom built environments just for agents, right? And so, you know, the idea that like, if you want an agent to be able to do all of these things for you, it's super clunky for it to have to go in and like kind of like hack together the like keystrokes and whatnot it needs for the old human readable web. And so one of the best examples that I've seen of this is, you guys, I don't know if you met Jordy. You may have met Jordy when he was here in town. Jordy used to be an engineer at Lightning Labs, and then he left to start a company called FewSats. And he's basically trying to build payment infrastructure for agents, so agentic payments. And one thing that he realized, and I realized with him in talking a lot about this and going down this path, is that if you want to build that, that's great. But like, first, we actually need just services that agents can use. And I haven't dropped, I actually have a pod reporter with Jordy that I'll probably drop in the next couple of days. But if you go check out SherlockDomains.com, and let me see if I can get back in the chat here. This is pretty sweet. It's Sherlock.
Do you want to screen share it? Or?
That's okay. I mean, I'll drop it in the chat. But anyways, it's the first domain registrar for agents. And that's like, it's a very, very simple or trivial example, but it's a very important one, right? Because like, if you want, you know, imagine you give the agent the task, go out there and, you know, make any money doing X, Y, Z thing, you need to be able to first get a website. And like, how do you get a website? If you're an agent and you have to go back and, you know, deal with Namecheap and all this stuff, you're going to see people at first try and kind of hack it together, but then there's going to be so much spam that it's going to be very difficult to build up, which brings me to the dead internet theory. But I'll pause there for a minute just in case you guys have any comments on Sherlock or some of this agentic infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, Sherlock is as kind of, I guess each one of these things is a cool idea in itself, but as you make advances and you lurch forward in one direction, you almost obviate whole swaths of other technical layers that could have been built.
Good point.
So when I hear about that, I'm like, well, yeah, like if domains kind of stay the same, then we need this. But like our domains or kind of resource addressing, that's going to be through cryptographic keys. Like it's just a public key anyway. So what role does Sherlock domains play when all these are just addressed via kind of a public key?
100%. Although I mean, to be clear, this is obviously like a demo. You have to start somewhere kind of in the world. But I don't think the old web ever entirely dies. Like, I think this is kind of like the sort of Kevin Kelly idea that, you know, any technology, it ends up existing, but it's just much, much smaller. Like, if you want to go and find some like old flour mill that you can grind by hand, like it's still out there. And similarly, I don't think domains and all that's going to go away. But as a relative percentage of where people spend their time, GDP, it's going to continue to go down over time. And that makes total sense. I think that's a good kind of point to transition as we think about designing this new plumbing for the internet with payments, hopefully built in. What is that going to look like if it's all going to be public-private key? So DK gave the setup earlier of dead internet theory. For those of you who have not heard of dead internet theory, it's worth searching and reading a bit about it. It was originally started, proposed as a post on 4chan or 8chan, one of the chans, where all great ideas began. And the gist of it was, I think it was in 2017. It was certainly, you know, in the 20 teens. And the gist of the post was that we were already at a point where the internet was all bots and any interaction that you were having online was essentially fake, or at least was essentially not human. And at the time, you know, a lot of people talked about this, at least in, you know, certain corners of the internet. It seemed a little far-fetched, like, okay, yes, there's definitely more bots on Facebook and Twitter. Like that's a problem. Like, okay, it seems like this person's, you know, a little too far ahead of the curve. By 2025, I think we're already there. And if we're not there, we're certainly going to get there this year. I think we already saw when Elon bought Twitter, trying to determine the real number of users of humans versus bots. That was something that was obviously a tremendous amount of controversy. I don't think there was ever any clarity reached on how many humans there actually were, because it's impossible to know how many humans there actually are. And just in general, like, you know, we talked last week, you're already starting to see a lot of companies experiment on purpose with putting these bots in there to get interaction. So Zuckerberg with Meta is all of a sudden, you know, already running experiments where if you make a post, you get all these responses, which make you feel great about yourself. But it turns out, you know, it's all a simulation or simulacrum. By the way, I think that would be a cool company, simulacra.ai. It's something like perhaps social network where you at least embrace that and are very open and honest.
There was, I just saw this shared this past week. I think one of the venture twins, Justine Moore or Olivia Moore, shared a live streaming app where you live stream and all of the fans and audience are fake. But she said it actually feels kind of real. It feels like, oh, I'm having fun. I'm interacting with.
Well, so, I mean, here's
real quick. I just wanted to insert something and we can either discuss it now or just cue it up for a little bit. But we just saw today the prime minister from Spain, who is speaking at Davos, suggest or recommend or clamor for no one being anonymous on the internet. And the only way you can engage on the internet is with an ID, and each person gets an ID. So there's that idea floating out there. There's also, you know, proof of human concept. And one approach to address that is Sam Altman's WorldCoin, which is a cryptocurrency that you have to put your eyeball in front of this orb to capture your eye scan. And then you get issued $100 of WorldCoin for that. And then you have proof of human through that system. So both of these are like super controversial. You know, many would say distasteful, you know,
Dystopian,
the wrong direction. I raise it though as the general category of like, what are mechanisms to do
identity, proof of human, and in this concept of debt.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and those are great points. By the way, Steve is not joking. The orb is a real thing and primarily targeted at users or people in essentially emerging markets, poor countries where that's a lot of money and like scanning eyeball. I don't know. Like, yeah, it sounds horrible. And
I mean, who's even allowed to administer the eyeball scan?
Dude, that's a great question.
There's so much corruption. Can I scan your eyeball and only give you $50 and keep 50 for myself?
Like, I don't know. It's, you got one of those kidneys I could just buy $20 right here, man. I got a scalpel.
There's recent reports of like gangs forcing people to do this and then taking the WorldCoin cryptocurrency.
Yeah. I mean, why not? It just seems obvious. Wouldn't that happen? Just if you just look at incentives, that's the way the world works.
Yeah.
I've always wondered. Scanning people's eyeballs.
I mean, the fact that Sam Altman is behind this and OpenAI, like, I mean, is the grand plan that in order to use OpenAI, you need to use I'm serious. Like, I don't think anyone's ever talked about that. He's never talked about it, but it's pretty interesting. It's two major projects or three. One's energy, one's AI intelligence, and one's, you know, a pretty dystopian global coin.
I think it's hard to prop up a coin that nobody cares about by tying it to a service that there are many competitors and alternatives to.
I hope you're right. But if they really get super intelligence and there are no competitors, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that, but I don't put it at zero. Anyhow,
I'm confident the exchange rate between Bitcoin and WorldCoin will continue to be favorable to Bitcoin holders over time. Even in this dystopian future, you have to use WorldCoin to use some service you want. You'll be able to get more WorldCoin for your Bitcoin in the future than you can now.
I hope it doesn't come to that.
And we see that playing out empirically with ETH. The story was always you need to hold ETH. And if you want to use these DeFi things, you need to use ETH. And it's just crashed compared to Bitcoin since 2017 was the relative. So even if you care about and believe in ETH and want to hold NFTs that you pay for in ETH, you're still better off holding the Bitcoin and then just transacting, swapping it in and out, getting the service you want and getting back to Bitcoin with whatever you have remaining.
Yeah. And that, by the way, for folks who haven't read it, John Pfeffer put out his utility token thesis in late 2017. And that was the general gist of it, is even if you need Chuck E. Cheese token for whatever network or whatever service there is, Bitcoin is energy-backed money. Nothing competes with it as long as you can swap in and out of that. And we've talked in the past, perhaps in future shows, we'll even deeper about the idea of Lightning Network-enabled exchanges between any chains that have HTLCs like Solana, like ETH or whatever, and Bitcoin. So I think that's all great. But coming back to the dead internet theory, and Steve, you make a great point. So, you know, first of all, we presume that you care about what's authentic and what's human and not. And like, maybe I'm just like, you know, I'm willing to allow that maybe I'm totally wrong and most people just don't care and like just want to live in like complete virtual worlds. And like, okay, if that's the way it goes, I think there's always going to be some strong segment of humanity that for whatever reason, and maybe I'm just, this is the boomer in me, but it's like, no, like, I don't want to just live in simulations and simulacra. I want to experience truth in whatever way, shape, or form you want to say that. I want to know who's a human and who's a bot. If you do care about those things, and I think a lot of people will, at least in the transition period, then I think you have two ways of doing this. You can do exactly what Steve is saying, which is you can have a centralized party be the arbiter of truth. And this is the same thing, you know, with Bitcoin and banking, right? Like one way to be is you have a central bank, which is the arbiter of truth. It can, you know, create the money or take it out of existence. And in doing so, you trust that bank. And, you know, there's a lot of problems that come with that trust, but there is big advantages as well, which is that it's something everyone else can, can use for coordination. The other possibility, which is something that Steve and I had a fascinating conversation with some visitors about yesterday, but is this concept of the web of trust, an emergent web of trust, right? Which is, you know, looking at evolution, can you have all of the parts come together into a new whole that you can trust in a way that you don't have to trust a centralized party? Bitcoin did this, and this was the beauty and the novel innovation of solving the Byzantine generals problem using energy or proof of work. And in doing so, we have a ledger of who owns, you know, something without trusting the owner. And obviously there's trade-offs there. It's expensive, it's slow relative to other things that are centralized, but you don't have to trust. And so all the issues that come with that erosion of trust over time, you lose. Similarly, for this dead internet theory or using the internet in a way that you don't have to trust a centralized party like a government or a company is using public-private key cryptography. So the real crypto, not cryptocurrency, but cryptography. And, you know, we've talked some on the show about Nostr, but I think you know, for me, the reason I'm so bullish on Nostr is, you know, people maybe have heard projects or companies like Primal, which is similar to something like a Twitter. But the real beauty of Nostr is, I believe it fulfills the vision of PGP, pretty good privacy, the original cypherpunk idea, in a way that is going to be accessible to billions of humans and trillions of machine intelligences. And so the way Nostr works is you have a public-private key pair. That's your identity. Similar, in fact, it's actually the same as a Bitcoin key, but that's a topic of conversation. And so what that means is anyone can create as many identities as they wish, public-private key pairs, super trivial to spin up. These public-private key pairs are very important because you can publish your public key in such a way that someone can say, I can then validate for any message that is produced, the private key associated with this public key signed it, i.e., I can trust, there's authenticity that whoever manages this public key is in fact the person that said this message and made this post on Twitter, this post on Facebook, that published this piece of music on Spotify, that did whatever on the internet. So from just an authenticity point by itself, it's absolutely huge because there's nowhere else on the internet, full stop, other than maybe the small subset of users that use PGP keys, where you can guarantee that the controller of a pub key is the person that published a message. That's super important. Then on top of that, you know, the next question becomes, well, okay, that's great. But if you can trivially, you know, spin up all of these identities for you as a human, maybe for a machine as well, then why should I have any trust in it? And that's where this idea of the emergent web of trust comes in. To me, web of trust, in my opinion, is probably the coolest and most interesting thing happening in the world right now, like around AI, like a sort of like adjacent to it, other than obviously AI itself is interesting. And the reason for that is because it fundamentally represents something new in evolution. It's a new superorganism where you can say, you know, because of a series of actions that this private key took, i.e. that could be a series of messages it sent, it could be people it follows on various sites like Reddit or Twitter, or it can be payments that it executed. Right now, all Bitcoin Lightning payments or eCash payments backed by Bitcoin Lightning. All of a sudden, you have all these different analytics that you can start to combine together to create essentially a decentralized graph. And that graph allows you to verify authenticity for different actors. And if you have different people vouching, you know, either explicitly or implicitly that, hey, you know, there's 1,000 different keys claiming to be DK, the fact that Steve follows this DK and the fact that Bob sent a payment, you know, a zap or a tip of, you know, 100 sats to this DK, all these different signals come up and say, I can say with 99% probability, this is the real DK and all the others are imposters. And in my mind, that's that sort of key concept is why Nostr is going to pop off, I think, this year. I think it's going to be much bigger than people realize because there is no other alternative for authenticity that doesn't require going down to scan your retina or KYC to log on to.
Yeah, I agree. Now, an even stronger advocation I'll make for why this stuff makes sense today is that I think that the public internet is going to get so swamped. This dead internet theory is so correct. It's going to be so swamped. We're going to learn to trust nothing that we see on the public internet. We'll have bots using the infrastructure to book us flights and do our apps, but we will learn to not trust anything that we read in public. I think what that means is we're going to first migrate actually toward a more private or kind of a higher fidelity version of internet usage. It's like what we're doing right now with each other is a much higher fidelity. You know, we happen to be broadcasting it out, but I know that I'm talking to you guys. I know I'm not talking about.
How right? do you know that?
And I have, because Max, I've known you long enough, we have enough shared experiences. I could pull on a memory of something that I know that we each know that was never recorded to the internet. I could raise that and challenge you and you could respond. Same with Steve. So I'm not going to do it right here, but I could verify that with each of you. So
not another adult story.
Definitely not for me.
Steve, you said.
But if you're saying that we trust right now that we're talking to each other and we know we are, it's because historically it's been impossible to like fake video and voices and mannerisms. But as we all know, that's quickly coming to a close. And like with the internet, like so text-based social media, like I still trust like x.com/DKSF is you. And when I read content there, I assume it's you.
Yeah, so, I think it's still true today.
And that's still true today.
Yeah.
So for dead internet theory, are we saying both of those become untrue? Like those accounts would be taken over and hacked, and there'd be no, there basically it's the end of cybersecurity, or what do we mean?
I think in my view of it, I think I would stop wanting to go on X because there's too much other random nonsense and noise there. And because I stopped choosing to go there to consume things, I also stopped going there to choose to publish things. So the whole of like the algorithm, the stuff it feeds me, it just becomes too much noise, too many reasons that I'm like, okay, I'd rather just have a bot read it for me and give me the headlines according to what I believe I want to see. Like, don't show me yet another post of person X, Y, or Z who has maybe a big audience, but maybe I don't necessarily feel like is telling me the truth, but that the For You algorithm wants me to see. Instead, let my local bot read my feed and pull out stuff that I think is actually interesting. But then I'm actually in a different consumption space, and I probably don't publish then directly into X. I just publish into that other consumption space, whether that's directly into Noster or into some bot that mediates my interactions with the internet. And one of the destinations is Noster, or maybe one of the destinations still is X for a while. But I think over time, we just creep away from our dependence on that kind of network.
I'm still not sold on why it can't be public content, and like people wouldn't still be incentivized to publish public, because if there's an increase in noise, first of all, if you have a feed that is strictly just show me who I follow, then you don't get the noise. Now, what we've seen from what we actually see in reality is content that from folks that you don't follow being defaulted or forced into your view, or even if you switch away, it switches back. Because it increases engagement due to like getting you riled up or emotional appeal.
Manipulation. Right? Yeah.
Manipulation. But that can be solved other ways too. And like something I think we've at least spent a little bit of time talking about on this podcast is just how with the Noster approach, you can have like you can have many different algorithms. You can have no algorithm. But I think a lot of people have tried no algorithm. That's not necessarily optimal either. It's a good choice to have, but it's not necessarily optimal. So having like lots of algorithms, having a library of algorithms and letting people choose in a marketplace and maybe even pay for it, all that makes sense, I think, to the three of us. And all of that can be consistent with public consumption. It's also can be public content creation. It also can be consistent with what you mentioned about an AI agent going out and doing a bunch of work for you. I guess the only thing I'm questioning or would like to learn more why you say this is that why would I no longer create public?
And
I think
the way I posed it actually on X in public today is there was this thread I shared with you guys. And the way I pose it is I think we're going to go from like the public internet is going to be basically we're going to continually degrade our trust in the public internet. And I think that's already in progress. And we're going to move more of our conversations to private channels, whether it's fully encrypted or fully verified. Like when I'm on our group chat, I know that I'm talking to the two of you guys. I know it's not a bot. Whereas like when I see stuff on, like sometimes I see a tweet on Twitter that's actually a parody account, but it actually has kind of smartly obfuscated the detail of that. And kind of there's ways to sort of make that tricky. And so I'm always on the alert. I'm always wondering like, wait, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? What am I seeing? Why am I seeing this? Whereas when I'm in a chat with you guys, I'm just letting it rip. I'm just being me. I'm talking. I have no concerns about is it real or not.
I think you're going to see this go in waves. And I think there's a couple of different ways this could play out. I think more people are going to leave quote unquote to Noster. And by the way, actually, I even want to take that statement back because I don't think Noster is in competition with X or anything else. In fact, one of my predictions is that eventually X will plug into Noster and it will make all of its account users on X, like so DKSF, you'll be able to link that to your pub key. And I think, I think Noster is very much, it's an underlying protocol. When people say protocol, I know it's like, what the hell does that actually mean? Well, it means you should be able to link it to whatever services that you're using. But I actually think the way it's going to go is I think you're going to have kind of like three big buckets of transition to Noster. One bucket's going to be loss of trust. One bucket is going to be new things that you can do on Noster that you can't do elsewhere. And then another bucket is going to be just the protection of your attention. And maybe those two and three can kind of come together. So on the first one, just like losing trust, I actually think X is going to be the last site to fall. Maybe X and Reddit will actually stay here for a while. I think that the first place this is going to manifest itself is the quote unquote public internet, which I think Google is kind of, you know, I published a post a couple of years ago talking about Google absolutely dying. It's only gotten worse since then. This is why I'm so bullish on companies like Coggy.com, which is, I think it's not just, they're actually getting into Noster now, but they have the right incentive model. And I think you're going to see this in more and more Noster services where the customer is the person. There's no advertising. The customer is the user. So the user is paying for a service and therefore it's very clear what they're paying for, what they're getting. So I think the public internet using Google is going to decline over time. For people that have any idea about how any of this stuff works or any sophisticated users, we already saw kind of like Hacker News has left Google for Coggy over the last couple of years. And I think you're going to see that trend accelerate. So I think dead internet theory is going to just absolutely destroy public internet search and like kind of like lower tier networks and things like that. I don't think it's going to destroy Reddit or X.com initially. I think that'll maybe happen over time. I think Elon, to his credit, you know, he, I think, has improved X in a lot of ways since he took it over and like continues to do great things. In fact, I think he's even borrowing ideas that he sees on Nostro, potentially like the Bitcoin lightning tipping that we discussed with Brian Romelli. And so I do think that in the short term, I think he's going to guard X pretty well from too much fake, but there's only so much he can do. Like there's still going to be, you know, lots and lots of bots. He hasn't been able to totally reel them in. And over time, even if you think Elon's awesome, like he's still a human being and like he's one person, like he's not going to be there forever. And, you know, even if he is, even if he has great intentions in lots of ways, he's still not neutral. And so, you know, over time, you know, the way he tweaks the algorithm, if it's not public and open, you know, I think it's going to be like the frog boiling and still get worse and worse and worse. So that's the first thing, though. I think the public internet usage with Google's going to get hammered way harder than X or Reddit. And by the way, some would argue that Google is, in fact, just a wrapper for Reddit anyway, for people that know what they're doing. The second thing I would say is that people will start transitioning in a way to guard their attention. And this is where I would transition away from X. As much as I like X and I happen to like Elon, I still hate scrolling. In fact, I've gotten rid of all scrolling apps from my phone. I'm like really trying to be intentional this year about spending less time on screens in general. And, you know, even though I do find good stuff on X relative to the rest of the internet, like is my life better for having, you know, played around on X for an hour and like seen like some really cool things, but also wasted like 50 minutes of that time? In my opinion, no. Like I know I am much happier when I am walking outside. And if I'm on my computer, I'm like on Coggy, like trying to actually read like old school blogs and things that I really like. I'm not saying I'm perfect. Like I'm also addicted. We're all addicted to, you know, all the dopamine from Twitter. But the thing that I would definitely use an AI bot for would be, hey, yeah, exactly what you're saying, DK. I only want to spend 10 minutes reading today. I want you to just, you know, summarize the best stories for me. If I need to click a link to go further, great. And that's it.
And realize that what that is, I'm couching it as a AI bot that we're kind of imagining maybe local, and really that is an algorithm that I control.
Yeah.
So I think the whole thing really comes down to algorithms. And so I think this erosion of trust, and whether it's Google and Coggy or X to Nostr or other things, the erosion of trust is all about an algorithm that is not in service of me, the end user, but that's in service of the advertising needs of the platform. Now, I'm not going to predict that Google's advertising needs go away immediately, but like I think Ben Thompson wrote a great piece around the Google moonshot. Like, could they actually transition to a world where they're monetizing through sales of a Pixel phone that's deeply integrated with the search experience that's just like an AI search experience and gets you the right answer, the right information, and you don't have to go through the 10 links, you don't have to go through all the, you know, attention arbitrage. I think that that's a credible path. I also think there's a credible path for X to become a client of Nostr and maybe monetize by selling AI services like Grok. So there's opportunities still for these existing platforms with huge distribution, but I think there's going to be continued erosion of trust in the large platform. And if there's an erosion of trust and there's alternatives where we can use a local AI, or we say, hey, like instead of using local AI is another word, maybe you could say a transparent algorithm. Maybe the platforms would say, like, instead of using that local AI, which feels kind of like an ad blocker, why don't you use our transparent algorithm marketplace? And now you can regain trust in those platforms because you know what the incentives are. You know why they're providing you what content they're providing you. And they maybe aren't monetizing via ads, but they're monetizing via AI services that they're direct selling, that you're direct paying for.
Yeah.
Right. So I think there's just like a lot of those kinds of changes. So to Steve's point, it's not like you will look at X in its current form today and look at the handle DKSF and not believe that it's me. It's just like, we just won't gather there in that way anymore.
So why isn't, there's definitely developer activity on Nostr and entrepreneurship, but why isn't there like 10x more? And why isn't Silicon Valley tapped into this opportunity, like real business and market opportunity?
I mean, this is literally the trillion-dollar question. And I'm making a huge bet that this is the year people do get on the radar. I'm very curious for anyone listening to the chat. Maybe you guys have thoughts as well. But I think it's a couple of things. I think Nostr is Bitcoin, I was saying 2011 era, maybe now it's 2012. It's gotten a little bit further ahead. So it's still very early. You know, it was to the point where like it was very jank. You know, when Jack tweeted about it in December of 22, I believe, or 23, already missing my years, 22. To get on there, you had to be pretty technical to play with it. So we churned through a lot of users. We had, you know, over a million humans sign up. And, you know, now we're to the point where we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of real humans on there, tens of thousands of daily active users, which is a start, but it's nothing compared to what it could be or what it should be. I truly believe that there is a tremendous lack, one, of awareness. Most people don't even know about Nostr, right? So like, or if they do, they heard about it once from Jack 2 years ago, and then they forgot about it. And so just telling people, as we had an experience with, you know, a mutual, I guess, friend or colleague or whatever yesterday, just telling them what's going on gets people very interested. And like the guy that we were talking to, he knew about Nostr, didn't know what was all happening. Like, seems like he's pretty interested now. So that was purely awareness. Number two, I think the way it's being pitched or it's been pitched so far is, you know, it's like, oh, it's like this social competitor to X. And let's be clear, anything that just tries to compete with X head on, like if I've learned one lesson in the last, you know, decade, it's don't ever take on Elon or short Elon. Like you're not going to win. Like any individual product or whatever that's trying to take on Elon, not going to happen. But instead, if you said, hey, social is the, as DK always says, water cooler feature for a broader internet-wide identity and data system, all of a sudden you start to see a lot more possibilities. Like the example yesterday, we were talking to this guy about him. Hey, if I could have a recruiting service that can look at all of your Nostr, you know, cookie crumbs from other places that you opt in to share, that helps me economically as a business owner pick out the right people and spend a lot less. That's interesting. You can't do that with X. So I think that's part of it, is just the way it's been pitched is like more of like a social media client. I think third thing is that sadly, the people who would naturally get excited about this thing, you know, as we've discussed in our chat ad nauseum, have been shitcoining and talking about doing this on the blockchain for a decade. And like when you come to them, I shit you not, you know, and to be clear, I know all of us have invested in Nostr stuff. My fund has been extremely active. I would say I've got close to, if not over now, 10 investments that are very, very focused on Nostr. So there is activity, but every investor that I speak with in the mainstream Silicon Valley, one of the first questions they say is, well, how do I invest in this? Like, will you invest in the actual companies? They're like, with what? I'm like, with equity. And they're like, but where's the token? Like, there isn't a token. And they say, well, how do you make money then? I'm like a business through cash flows. And everyone's like, nah, I don't know about that. And so I truly think a huge subsegment of the people who would have gotten excited are still, whatever, doing the token thing and will come back over time. But to your point, I don't know. I also think, frankly, one last piece, something is super, super important. And something I think the three of us and other people in our sort of orbit can fully move the needle on is we don't have enough yet. We're getting there, entrepreneurs and designers. Like we've got the gnarly hackers. It's like early YC or even before YC, the guys that are, you know, like really, really deep into Linux and stuff. And they're there and they're building really cool proofs of concepts. But outside of a small handful of entrepreneurs that know how to actually make money and ship a beautiful product and a UX that a normal person can use, like, it's too proof of concept at the stage, but we can change that very easily. Like we need just entrepreneurs to learn about it and come build. What do you think?
Well, go ahead. You can go, DK, but we love audience engagement on this show and we've got a couple queued up. So I was going to, move to that real quick. We love audience engagement so much. We have multiple ways to engage and I'm looking at the X live chat. Okay. Not the Riverside chat. Up. And the first one
so
is...
so many different...
I know, there's two engage. Nostr solves this.
On dating apps on Nostr.
No.
That's why I wanted to make sure I asked this so that you guys get an
answer. Oh, boy. Okay. Well, if you're talking dating apps, you actually have to have dating identities of people you would want to date.
But what if...
only Max and I are the people.
What if it's a dead internet and you're trying to date? What do you do?
What's worse, a dead internet or a sausage fest? I don't know.
The other point was made by a friend of ours who's a little more skeptical of Noster. He says, Excel subscriptions, not advertising. The answer to why not more dev activity is that there is not as much consumer demand for algorithmic selection and self-sovereign identity as you guys posit.
I want to be really, really clear on this because I think that's a really good point. My understanding is Xtool does do ads too, right? But I get it. Elon is moving into other business models, including subscriptions and payments, which is why I believe he was actually trying to move the headquarters of San Francisco. And so that's great. And again, I think Elon is well aware of Noster, and I think probably borrows some really good ideas that he sees happening there, like lightning payments. I think the reason Noster is going to win is not because of the self-sovereign identity. It's not because people necessarily want to choose the algorithm themselves. I think they want that. They don't realize they want. And so, yes, there's going to be some percentage of early tech adopters, the kind of people from Hacker News that went to Coggy. They will absolutely pay for this, and we're going to see that happen for sure. And by the way, you can build real businesses there. I mean, we talked about this. Coggy, you know, has 30,000 plus paying monthly active users, paying $10 plus a month. You can build real businesses on this right now. That's all public. Everyone can see that data. But to be clear, the reason I'm so bullish on Noster versus any of these other systems is because it's open. You can run any experiment you want. And so if you go to, I don't know where the chat is, I don't know who actually asked us that, but if they go to nosterapps.com, I believe, you can see there's literally like over 100 interesting experimental apps. Yeah, nosterapps.com. You can see all these, to be clear, they're hacky, but all these different interoperable apps that people are experimenting with. Some AI stuff, some social media stuff, podcast app like Fountain, music app like Wave, like long form, you know, content stuff. Highlights, for those of you who remember Rap Genius, you can do Rap Genius in a decentralized way now. And so what I would say is the reason Noster is going to win is not just because people are going to get, you know, find Jesus or find Satoshi, so to speak, and want their own identity. It's going to be because they can do crazy cool stuff on Noster with all of this interoperable ecosystem they can't do elsewhere. What does that mean specifically? Because we've been saying this for years, and it's a fair question. Why hasn't it taken off yet? I think in addition to the authenticity thing that makes it pop this year, and also creators coming over and realizing they can get paid a lot. Like I think Million from Primal had a new creator. I forget, some, you know, sort of Bitcoin adjacent self-sovereignty kind of guy.
Right.
He got 500,000, you know, sats zapped in the first 2 hours when he joined Noster. So that's awesome. So you're starting to see people get paid. But I think you're going to see brand new opportunities. And so there is a thread I share with you guys from Stacker News, from Aljaz, who also keeps the GitHub list of awesome Noster, which is even a longer list of Noster projects than what you see on nosterapps.com. He put up a thread, and I can try and find that thing I have on the list. His thread is this idea to, quote, bootstrap a parallel economy with data vending machines. And so this is an example of something, whoever the listener was, you cannot do with X today because their APIs are closed. They don't let you do what you want to do with it. Elon may open it up with really good ideas because he's a smart guy. But as of right now, you can't do something like this. And so the concept of a data vending machine, this was a spec that was put out about a year ago by Pablo, one of the most prolific Noster devs. And the idea was that you can basically put out a request for a job, any job that you can imagine, with a piece of data and a payment. And you can get a quote from, you know, all this free market of, you know, actors to do that job for you. So one very simple example is I want a transcription of this podcast done. I'm willing to pay 100 sats. And you bend that out, and then, you know, there's 100 different OpenAI or open source or whatever models, and you choose the one you want, or maybe that's done by software for you. And you make your payment and you get the transcription. And you can also string all these things together. They're composable. Composability is also very key. So Aljaz has this really cool idea with data vending machines that, you know, if you guys remember in 2020, you started to see a lot of the Bitcoin hobbyist community start running nodes, lightning nodes, like Umbral, trying to make money. It was, of course, way too early to make money. It was like fun, but like way too early. It's still too early to make money riding payments via lightning node. But imagine each of those 20,000 plus Umbral owners, I think that's how many units they sold that year, could install a little Noster package that said, hey, I'm going to offer this service and offer it in a free market to anyone that wants to use it. One very simple example of that service might be, I can download YouTube videos for you. Now, as sites like YouTube try and shut down, you know, non-residential traffic or, you know, potentially traffic coming from a virtual private server, then this might be a way for you to be able to pay someone to go scrape some content from their local, you know, home IP address you know, at a rate they charge you, and then they send you the video. And so that's like a very simple example, but you can kind of see the kind of thing you could start doing with DVMs. Now, where this becomes very powerful is that they're all composable. So you could say, I have 10 different services I want. I want to create an ad. And creating an ad, I need you to scrape the video. I need you to transcribe the video. I need you to take that transcription and convert it into a background piece for an ad. I need you to write the copy for the ad. I need you to create the list. And oh, by the way, open source operator, I need you to actually go out there and send the email to everyone. And each of those could be different services offered with only an MPUB, only an Ostra identity with a data vending machine. Anyways, all that to say, I think the reason that we're going to see a lot of people move over besides authenticity is to make money. And I think there's going to be more opportunities to make money here in this open ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a little bit of a, I'll point out a cultural mismatch that I think is holding Nostr back, because I do think Nostr works well as an infrastructure. And I would agree, Max, with your idea that you need to help people make money. But your examples of helping devs make money is also interesting. I think it's helping creators make money is what's going to drive the content that drives the attention, that drives audience to come there. But I think there's a cultural mismatch today that exists, which is basically anybody who builds a Nostr client is very, you know, transparent, open source, algorithms are evil, has this kind of very pure ideological stance. And I believe that algorithms are extremely useful to people. I believe an algorithm is literally heavy computer do the work for me instead of me do the work. So I think an algorithm is extremely useful. And the problem is every algorithm we've seen has been part of a central organization, centralized provider who controls the database and controls the client and controls the algorithm, right? And so if you control all of that, then every algorithm you've ever seen has been basically not in service of the end user. You've never seen an algorithm in service of the end user. And what we can do, and everybody in Nostr basically rails against this idea, is you can actually build an algorithm that's in service of the end user. Now, I know that DVMs kind of dabble with this idea, and Primal has done some experimentation, but it's not a core experience to any Nostr client to say, like, we believe in algorithms. Algorithms are literally helping people use this better. This is a computer in service of a person. And now we're going to take this open source, transparent, fully open source thing. We're going to pair it with an algorithm. And we've got money available, right? And all of that together is something that we haven't seen yet. And there's an ideological mismatch between who develops on Nostr and the usefulness of algorithms. Like, people will just barely dip their toe in the water, but they won't actually lean into it and be like, this is a core experience we need. Let's build something like TikTok, where you just swipe and you get another thing that's algorithmically generated. And then if you like it, you pay a lightning tip. And somebody, like, you gave a few of those examples of those creators on Primal, but somebody's going to walk away with $1 million for creating a cool video. And today on Nostr, nobody can go viral. The concept of going viral is impossible. Now, I don't want to be controlled by somebody else's algorithm, but I'm fine taking, you know, as a first order, send me something, show me an algorithm, show me some algorithmic content. If I like it, fine. If I don't, not. But I have, like, actually, Will just did a little demo of this. Where did you see this demo that Will put together? So Will is developer of Domus, one of the large Nostr apps, where the kind of, I think he's taking like the dwell information or some of the information about how the user interacts with the client and stores it locally and uses it to sort of improve the service. So it's like an algorithm in service of the end user, but it doesn't look very traditional. My point is, show me some content, help content go viral, because creators want to go where they can build audience. If you have a service that's like purely ideological and neutral, but can't help people build audience, nobody wants to go there. And today there's too much of a cultural mismatch between the ideology of Nostr and the benefits to users. And I don't think it's unbridgeable, but I think so far it's unbridged.
I think that's a great point. And I want to offer maybe one addendum to that. And then I'm curious for both of you guys what you would build if you were jumping in right now. So I think there's another sort of simple explanation for how Nostr could pop off this year as well, which is because I think that the challenge is it's a chicken and egg problem, right? So we've got hundreds of thousands or millions of users that have signed up, tens of thousands that are looking. They're mostly Bitcoin people. They're mostly freedom focused. You know, you're starting to see a little bit of that next kind of adjacent to Bitcoin. So someone else that's more freedom focused, not exactly a Bitcoiner per se. my guess is if it goes that more traditional content creator route, what's going to happen is you're basically going to see Nostr adoption follow Bitcoin price this year. So you'll see one of these guys go over there. It's like, hey, on X, I love X, but like, you know, yeah, I make great money because I have great distribution, but like I'm getting paid out in dollars. I see someone else go to Nostr, they get paid in Bitcoin, and like all of a sudden, you know, in 8 months, you know, what was once I got paid $10,000 is now $70,000. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait a second. And I think as people start getting really excited about, you know, basically the price blew up the top in Bitcoin, if that happens this year, a lot of people will see Nostr as like a place to get that, to get paid in Bitcoin. So maybe that's how it happens. If it doesn't, how do you think we solve this chicken and egg problem? And I'll also pose this to anyone that's listening out there. I mean, I can speak for myself. Nostr is still my top priority for what I'm investing in. So if you are an incredible entrepreneur, or you are a designer, or you are in Silicon Valley, and you're like, wow, that sounds pretty cool, didn't even know that was possible, like, hit me up. Like, I'm looking to invest in the right teams. We haven't seen a ton of them yet. But DK and Steve, if you guys were jumping in there trying to bridge that gap right now, what would you be building in 2020?
Gambling and adult. I mean, I know I say it every week, but I'm saying that those are the atomic building blocks of the internet. That's the foundational layer. Those are the things that are so underserved, right? Like the censorship resistant, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to get, you know, I need free speech. Like that's like a problem you figure out a year later when you get censored, but you don't have that experience day one. Gambling and adult works day one. Like that's how the internet you use today was built on gambling and adult. And I think that's the same for Nostr.
Can't top that answer, but I do have breaking news, which is apparently the Trump administration just signed a crypto executive order. And there's nothing super surprising here, but they formed a committee which will do a number of things, including evaluating the creation of a strategic national digital asset stockpile. So
boy,
that suggests to me like there's no imminent announcement of an SPR.
But that XRP is still on the table.
I see Solana in this, oh Lord.
So it could be a stockpile of Melania coin or World coin. Sam Altman and Trump just announced something together. So maybe World coin is next.
Lord.
It also bans or prohibits agencies from doing basically anything to create CBDCs. So I think that's a big win. But I bring that up too, just because I know there are a number of topics we were hoping to talk about with the administration change this during this week in a real like inflection point just on crypto stances from being very, very, you know, the Biden administration is very anti-crypto and Bitcoin and everything. And now it feels way more Wild West. So Wild West that, you know, Trump and his family issued like new meme coins and made a boatload of money off of that.
Isn't most of their net worth is now in crypto?
I mean, and how you measure net worth. There's probably not a lot of liquidity in Trump coin. Even if there's like $1 billion that could be extracted, that's insane, right? I mean, within right. like 24 hours to go from zero to something that's rivaling your overall net worth that you've created over 78 years of your life is pretty wild. So anyway, we can talk about anything under, I mean, like Trump coin, SBR, what do you guys want to talk about?
Yeah. Or well, thanks another, for the breaking news.
Related, yeah. Another related thing is Senator Lummis was just given a subcommittee. So like, what does that mean for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin? Because Senator Lummis is very, very pro Bitcoin and specifically Bitcoin. So, you know, that's another thing we could dive into.
Do you get a sense? I've heard that. I mean, there's so much to talk about there, but just because you left it on Lummis, do you know much about sort of her history with it or sort of how she came to her convictions or beliefs and kind of what she said publicly?
I mean, just a little bit. I don't know the exact order of things or total story, but her son-in-law is a longtime Bitcoiner who I think at least some of us know, you know, so strong principles, really understands Bitcoin well. So undoubtedly, she's learned from him, and then also through him has been connected with many others in the Bitcoin space. I know that a person on her staff is a former Stanford law student who's now a lawyer, practicing lawyer, and he also has been a longtime Bitcoiner, strong ethos, Bitcoin ethos. So she's surrounded by people who understand Bitcoin really well, and far people far from like scams and number go up, but just really deeply principled Bitcoiners. She also ran for U.S. Senator in the state of Wyoming with like Bitcoin being like one of the top, if not the top, part of her platform, which is was really striking at the time. I guess what's it been four years ago or two? I don't know. Some 2 to 4 years ago. It must have been 4 years ago.
I think it's 4 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like notable in and of itself that like a politician would make it such a prominent part of their platform, and you know, getting a Senate, U.S. Senate seat is a big deal. So I think that's really good news for Bitcoin specifically, that she's been empowered even more so, and that the Bitcoin community has access to her and her staff, and hopefully some important issues with Bitcoin that really impact the long-term future around like what's considered money transmission, and some of the regulatory policies out of the U.S. Treasury can be impacted in a positive way.
Has she spoken at all about like the Banking Secrecy Act?
I'm not aware if she has or what her stance is. There's a range of things that could be done, right? I mean, at minimum, there's recent legislation from the infrastructure bill in 2021 under Biden that was under the Biden administration had some really bad, that's really bad law that was passed. You know, general and would allow regulators to make Bitcoin miners running a Bitcoin full node, running a Lightning node, effectively illegal, because it gave the scope of the law would allow for making an operator of any of that software needing to submit to the IRS tax reports for everyone's transactions and all of their KYC data. And of course, anyone running any of that software doesn't have that information. So it's not possible to collect that information. So it would effectively make it illegal. Now, that's not currently the actual regulations, but the law affords that. So any particular administration or agency could do that. And there's definitely proposals on the table that are unfavorable. So just simply rolling that back, which would require legislation, but with the new, you know, with the change in power, it could become a priority and some pressure applied there. That's one thing. But then, I mean, the more radical version is like undoing the BSA and like, you know, which is far less possible or practical, but at least maybe the Overton window shifts and like that becomes, goes from like being absurd and like impossible to like, well, maybe, or what does that look like? If we actually did that, what would that look like? And I'm actually interested in that intellectual exercise and that project. Just like, what does the world look like if we eliminate the BSA, roll it all back? Because there are some like well-intentioned public policy goals with these regulations. So are we okay with not trying to address any of them? Or if we, you know, or are there sensible regulations that we'd want to put in place if we were starting from scratch with the knowledge of the existence of Bitcoin and the knowledge of the past 50 years of history, what we've learned works and doesn't? And sorry, one last thing. And with knowledge of the hidden costs that I don't think any politician or public official ever intended. There's just a ton of costs that come with regulations that ultimately hurt the average person, average American citizen or global citizen. And I don't think that was ever like accounted for properly when setting some of these regulations.
I think this broader question of, you know, if you want free markets, you accept there's good and bad. I think it's important to be realistic with all of this. To your point, I think one, whether it's sort of willfully targeted with sort of regulations meant to damage things, like making it difficult to run a lightning node or something like that. That's obviously, I think there's no question it's a good thing that some of that's going to get, you know, easier or at least more clarity for businesses. But I also think, you know, yeah, to your point, it's like, you know, when you put regulations in place, there's all, like with BSA and all this other stuff, there's these unintended consequences. Then you come back and, you know, maybe it makes sense to put more sensible regulations in place. I think you have a lot of the more extreme Bitcoiners like, no, just have a free market. And I think a lot of them are also pretty upset, probably, I would guess, with all of the shitcoining and whatnot. I mean, I think on balance, most people would be pretty happy with what Trump has done so far versus not. But like, there's, in my mind, there's also no world in which you can't also acknowledge, like, it feels kind of slimy to like launch a meme coin and make a whole bunch of money. It looks like he moved some of that already into Bitcoin, or at least wrapped Bitcoin, you know, scam a bunch of people, make a quick buck, put it into something, you know, whatever, longer term. And honestly, I mean, I don't know. I have mixed feelings on this. And I think this is kind of the reality of like, there's trade-offs either way. And like, you know, Trump, what you're getting is you're going to get Wild West with him. I mean, I think you take the good with the bad. I mean, my only fear here is that if he goes so Wild West that, you know, it turns most of the country off on Bitcoin as part of crypto, or they see it's only these get rich quick scammer types. And then, you know, even though Trump's in power now, in 4 years, when another administration comes in, you get hammered even harder because of all the skeeziness. You know, that's a risk. But I mean, you know, I think there's also a decent chance that in this free market environment, people will get scammed. It sucks. I mean, I guess to be fair to Trump, he's not promising that Bitcoin, that Trump coin is going to beat Bitcoin or be the next Bitcoin. It's just, it is what it is. It's a silly meme coin. And to your point, DK, maybe this is the gambling that's necessary to build the internet of money. Like, if we don't have the gambling, we don't go mainstream. And like Trump, you know, if that man understands one thing, it's human nature. He gets people to do stuff. I don't know. I mean, like, part of me feels the whole meme coin thing is just very skeezy. Like, I personally, and I just find it very distasteful. But, you know, it's, if that's what you get with free markets, you got to take that, the good with the bad.
I think free markets is the word here, which is, you know, free markets may attract a lot of attention. And like, I sat there on the couch when the crypto ball was happening. I had X, and I see this thing, like, what? They're launching a meme coin? And I looked at it. I downloaded the stupid app where you could buy it, and it was like $6. And I was like, this thing is going to go up. Like, I just know it is. It was $6 at the time. I said, I don't have anything to do with this grift. But I think I heard somebody say something like 50% of people who bought, something we traded in our chat? 50% of people who bought the Trump coin had never purchased any Sol or any type of cryptocurrency before. So it was like their first onboard to it. Now, I think in the market of free ideas, you know, in the free market of ideas, I think it's actually, in a sense, it's fine. Like, people will try it. They'll get scammed. That's unfortunate. I wish they didn't have to. I wish they could educate themselves, seek truth, find good resources to learn. But, you know, not everybody's going to be ready for that. But I'd rather get in the free market and get burned and then realize, actually, there's a solution to getting burned. Bitcoin's actually the solution to the problem you just caused yourself. And you know what? Look, if you figure it out this month, next month, this year, next year, in the next 5 years, 10 years, Bitcoin is still good for you. It's still going to put you in a better place than if you didn't figure it out. So it's just a question of like, how long does it take you to figure it out? And if you bought the Trump meme coin and you lost money on it, you also start asking yourself the question, well, is all of this a scam? Is some of it a scam? Like, you start to become more curious about it.
Yeah,
you know,
that's, I think, an a lot of people have. That's an interesting argument. I mean, basically, like, $1,000 lost today might make you tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars later because you would have purchased Bitcoin sooner. Because you went through this experience of getting burned on an altcoin or a meme coin or something that doesn't have, that's like fun in the moment maybe, but doesn't have lasting value.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody gets drawn in for different reasons. I got really drawn in by like trying to understand what could be built with these primitives. And that appealed to me and my nature. And then that gave me tons of conviction about what Bitcoin really is and why it was special. But like, you know, without the idea that the primitives could be used for building things, I don't know that I would have figured it out when I did. Like, maybe it's a different set of people going to be attracted to the meme coin story, and they're going to get involved, but then get clarity. And it's just going to be kind of a constant, like, there'll be something after meme coins that drags a whole bunch of other people in for some other reason, you know? So I think it's just like, get more exposure, more marketing. And then also, like, the ultimate marketing is that, like, Bitcoin days or keeps going up and everything else seems to fade away over time.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it still doesn't make it, I mean, it still feels slimy, but
yeah, I agree. It's slimy. It is what it is. You know? So actually, let's talk about strategic Bitcoin reserve. Everybody talks about strategic Bitcoin reserve. In the past weeks, we've rugged our audience by claiming we were going to talk about it and not talk about it. Now we didn't think we were going to talk about it.
Strategic DK reserve, you say? What was that? Red Knot hat on Serrano? Strategic money buy reserve coming in too?
But what, like, can we talk through a little bit of what are the mechanics, or what's your understanding of the mechanics of what does strategic Bitcoin reserve mean? I think we hear a lot of people say things like, oh, it'd be great, you know, US government prints a bunch of dollars and buys a bunch of Bitcoin. Number goes up. Okay, I get it. That part I get. But like, is people talk about like helping with the national debt. Are people planning to like buy Bitcoin for the strategic reserve, have it pump, and then sell it to pay off the debt? Because that mechanic doesn't actually work in my mind, but maybe I'm missing something. What is strategic Bitcoin reserve? What are the mechanics of how this thing is actually meant to work?
Well, there's a range of options that have been discussed too. Anywhere from like the simplest and most plausible is simply a change of policy to not sell off seized Bitcoin. Like the US controls or owns like almost 200,000 Bitcoin right now, I believe.
Is that mostly Silk Road stuff, or that's other lots of activities?
Lots of activities, I think. I think they already auctioned off all the Silk Road Bitcoin, right, to Dan Draper. So that seems like, yeah, that seems like quite plausible and not super crazy. So that, I mean, that's one form of, there's far more extreme forms. I think RFK's speech in Nashville last summer, I forget the exact number that he proposed in that speech for a SBR, but it was a lot, like, a million Bitcoin, perhaps, was the number, or maybe even, no, I think it was 4 million Bitcoin. I think it was 4 million Bitcoin that the US would purchase.
And which is like on the order of like 20% of Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. And probably like more 10 like
MicroStrategies.
Probably, you know, more like 25% because of assumed lost Bitcoin forever. So that, I mean, that's obviously extremely audacious, probably not good for Bitcoin if one country owns a quarter of it. And it would be very, very costly to the US. I mean, it depends on how the US goes about funding it. But, you know, and then there, of course, there's things in between, like more pragmatic, like the US, I mean, like countries obviously have reserves, and US treasuries are the dominant form of reserve today, but it's not the only form of reserve. People hold euros and yens and gold as well. And there's other like synthetic things, I believe. Yeah, one concept is that Bitcoin's similar to gold. And as we know, Bitcoin's much better than gold in many ways. Country reserves.
Do we know mechanically like the reserves when a country holds gold as a reserve, is it kind of just a show of strength? Like, I have this, so our currency should be worth that, or I have this, so I'm going to borrow to build assets and infrastructure in the country? Or how do reserves actually get used? Do we know? This may be too much of a macro question for us. I don't know.
Yeah, ask Lynn.
Yeah, we know. And Lynn can answer this. I mean, I can make guesses, but I don't want to like, get, I mean, we would need someone more steeped in this to fully understand how the purpose of reserves and how they're used. Unless, you know,
at the very least, it's some sort of strength. I mean, there's no question. I mean, not out there flexing it because people will question if we even have the gold.
Right. I mean, it seems good to have it, but I'm interested in the mechanics of what you do with it. Do you borrow against it? Does it help strengthen your local currency in kind of forex currency markets? Like, I don't know, but like, it seems like there has to be some mechanic of how it works versus if it just sits there and you don't talk about it. You know?
I mean, the historical use of gold in reserves was that you literally could take your paper US dollars and exchange it for gold. One, it was a full reserve.
Redeemability.
you know, and now it's, and then I moved to fractional reserve, and now it's just like completely untethered from that.
Yellow. One thing, I mean, I think this is a very good question. There's no question that gold is one of many factors that gives some strength to the ability for you to print more of your currency. I mean, military, oil, there's lots of things that are in that mix. Maybe gold is a small percentage. But coming back to the Bitcoin strategic reserve and where that plays a role. So I think this is a really interesting question. I think it's really hard to predict how this rolls out. So if Trump just keeps the Bitcoin that the US has, then I think it's cool, but that's not a big story. Nothing really changes. Maybe some, you know, mild bump, you know, due to maybe 5-10% even, maybe, because people are more confident that, you know, that's not going to be sold, but nothing drastic. If he starts buying Bitcoin though, at any amount, I don't care what the amount is, that is a very big deal. And it's a big deal for a couple of reasons. I think one, it sparks FOMO. If the US is stacking BTC on their balance sheet, I guarantee you every country in the world is going to start stacking BTC. And, you know, now it's just kind of the province of kind of weird, you know, smaller countries. Like you got El Salvador doing it because of their weird situation where they didn't have their own currency, Bhutan doing it because they had lots of hydroelectric. But now all of a sudden it's like, okay, you're going to see like, you know, G20 countries doing it.
I think Armstrong was out there tweeting to the G20s. He said, hey, just in case the US is doing this, come talk to us if you want help with custody.
Exactly. I mean, and the fact that it's even on the table now, that's already like started, but if he actually starts doing it. So then what's crazy about that is like, if that actually happens, I mean, you're going to see a giant arms race where I think the price just freaking skyrockets and everyone's like too conservative, because now you have countries that can print their own money. And the game theory of this is, well, if I know this is the hard currency, the US is saying this is the hard currency, why would I not print my monopoly money as quickly as humanly possible to stack more of the hard currency? The US has already endorsed it. And if that happens, all bets are off. I mean, and also companies, right? Like you've got all these companies that were already kind of dipping their toes, trying to pull MicroStrategy. Everyone's doing it now. So you've got all the US companies with their money. The US is the government, all the governments, you know, the idea of the final cycle, maybe that actually happens if the SBR comes to pass. The question I have then is, Trump is in kind of a weird position. I don't know if he and his advisors have fully thought through this. I'm assuming they're trying to game it, but it's like, if on the one hand you want a strong dollar because you don't want to just like forfeit overnight, I think we've had this discussion. If you are, you know, the global reserve currency issuer, you see a threat on the horizon like China, this sort of Thucydides strap sense that we talked about. You also see this thing you think is probably going to win in the long run, Bitcoin. But you don't want to like give up your, you know, global reserve currency status too quickly, because then, you know, one, you lose all of this privilege. You're not able to stack enough to be the dominant player in the new regime, the new world regime. What do you do? And it's tough, because if there's a world where Trump can somehow say we're stacking Bitcoin, but we're using it like gold to help solidify the dollar, and the dollar is still the dominant, you know, payment rail, maybe that works, just because the dollar is such a strong brand. And it's kind of like what we've seen with Tether, where the governments move off of treasuries, which they already have been doing, and into Bitcoin, but the normal rank and file people are still buying and using dollars just because it's like, it's the greatest brand there is right now. But I just can't see that lasting that long. I mean, I think Nick Carter wrote a piece about this a while ago where he was basically like, don't do the SBR, because if you do, you're just going to like get rid of the dollar privilege way too fast, front run everything way too quickly. And I think he might be right. But on the other hand, it's like, if you look at this game, theoretically, the cat's already out of the bag. Companies are looking at, countries are, you know, looking at it. Trump wants to be seen as, you know, having the biggest number, whatever it is, he needs the biggest. And if you don't act now, you might not be in the position to do that. I mean, maybe as the US, you have 5 to 10 more years, maybe. I don't know. Like, I guess the question I'm struggling with is, can you start stacking Bitcoin publicly and keep the dollar as the dominant reserve currency for at least your administration?
One thing, we have an audience point here. Someone saying, cheering for the US to steal Bitcoin is wild. So I interpret that to mean, if the strategic Bitcoin reserve includes or is only holding seized Bitcoin, that Bitcoiners or people shouldn't encourage that. It could be interpreted as like theft of Bitcoin from citizens.
Yeah, it's true.
And just to be clear, I don't think any of us were like taking a position on whether to do it or not, or cheering that on. It's just it's an option that's been discussed. Uh-huh. But it's certainly, you know, that's also another important point to discuss with that as well. But it's also a little bit, I mean, when thinking about what the government should...
This clarification, it's stolen Bitcoin, not bought. So it incentivizes government to find reasons to seize citizens' Bitcoin. So you don't want to create an environment where...
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, that confirms we understood it correctly.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely a valid point. And it's unclear what percentage of the seized Bitcoin to date is what most people or what Americans would consider fair or just, and what percentage was not. But I guess to that person's point, even if most of the Bitcoin seized to date is just, does it change the incentive so that in the future it becomes less and less just?
Yeah. I mean, look, I agree. I think theft in general obviously is wrong and you don't want to incentivize it. I mean, it's already there. And like, I guess the alternative would be trying like to return to people. And then it does get in question. Like, there are obviously like things you don't want to encourage, like certain illegal activities. Maybe it was, I don't know the history of how it was all seized, but I think, in general, if one was purely playing as the role of the US government, we've talked about this, DK said this on the show many times as well. I do think the government will eventually nationalize Coinbase, MicroStrategy, and the big holders. I think that's going to happen. I would love to be wrong, but that's probably going to happen. And if that's part of the long-term game plan, honestly, it makes more sense that they would just kind of let MicroStrategy and a couple other companies just YOLO as hard as humanly possible through 2025 instead of doing it officially. And I think that's probably a route the US government to get more. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm not endorsing that. I'm just saying that's probably the route to stack the biggest pile possible. I don't know.
You might want to get some in case it catches on.
Yeah.
User BTC tells us.
Also, I just wanted to acknowledge, Curious had also said something before that, saying anyone looking to naming on Bitcoin was brought up by Brian at WF. That is a long conversation. We're not going to have time for today, but definitely something we should touch on next time. Short answer, we have been chatting about it, and DK can lead us on
that. We have been chatting, and I know we're out of time, so I want to wrap it, but it is one that I'm very excited about. We have been chatting, and I wanted to solicit your feedback, you two in particular, but also, I guess, a little bit up to the audience. As we do have, you know, I've played with a lot of projects. I've not found anything that I find credibly neutral enough yet. I have put forth a proposal in some private circles, but I'd like to figure out if you guys have advice on how to go about taking what I've shared with you in private and broadening for more. Should we be soliciting to get more input on it right now? Should we be finding a person or two to help kind of really get through technical details? Or should we just like make it a free for all, you know, kind of put it on GitHub and just like see what happens? You know, I'm not trying to be cagey about it. I'm happy to share more detail, but
I think it makes for a great topic for the show. So we can definitely discuss it here in a future show. Whether you publish what you have now or in the next iteration of it beforehand or after, you know, I'd say that's up to you. But, you know, I think it would be a good topic.
Yeah, and I'd also love to get solicit thoughts on this Spaces protocol as well. Curious just mentioned that. I saw they've got over one BTC burned as of 2 weeks ago, so it looks like there's some traction. I haven't figured out how to get it set up myself yet, so maybe I'll do that for our next show. But, like, I am curious, like, what people think about if it's legit, if they have criticisms, maybe things that we can incorporate in our discussion.
Cool. So yeah, and I've studied that one a bit. So happy to share kind of what I've learned so far. Great. Well, thanks, Curious, for the question. We'll talk about that more later. And thanks, Max and Steve. This has been a fun jam. We just let it rip, and that was fun.
Yeah, tons of fun.
Until next week.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, see ya.